Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, June 3rd, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, available via podcast on iTunes and the Stitcher app, as well as on the blog on Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com. You can also visit our Facebook page or our Twitter page for more information about the show, upcoming shows, or to comment on what you hear. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. Before we get started, this is my first time back since our spring fund drive, and I wanted to say a special thank you to the listeners who contributed during the drive. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive and would like to show your support for the show, you can always donate anytime by clicking the donate button at kuci.org. Now, on to today's show. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with British novelist Samantha Harvey. But first up, author Vendela Vida. Vendela is the author of four books, including Let the Northern Lights Erase Your Name and The Lovers. She is a founding editor of The Believer magazine. She is also the co-editor of Always Apprentices, a collection of interviews with writers, and Confidence, or The Appearance of Confidence, a collection of interviews with musicians. Two of her novels have been New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and she is the winner of the Kate Chopin Award, given to a writer whose female protagonist chooses an unconventional path. She lives in Northern California and since 2002 has served on the board of 826 Valencia, a nonprofit writing and tutoring center for youth. Her new book, just released yesterday, is The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty. And I am so pleased to welcome her back to the show. Hi there, Vendela.
Hi, Nicole. How are you doing?
Great. So your book, as I just mentioned, came out yesterday. So happy Pub Week.
Thank you.
Can we start by having you tell us a little bit about your book and how it came to be?
Sure. The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty is about a young woman who travels to Casablanca, Morocco on mysterious business. And while checking into her hotel, she's robbed of her backpack, which contains her wallet and her passport and all of her money and identification. And even though she goes to the police station and talks to the chief of police, she senses a strange undercurrent of complicity between the hotel and the police and the other authorities, and she just knows right away she'll never recover her possessions. So, of course, this is an obvious hardship. She's been in Casablanca without any belongings and any identification. But given what she's recently gone through in her life, she also finds a certain amount of liberation in what has transpired. She's now free to be whoever she chooses. She has a chance encounter with a movie producer that leads her to a job posing as a stand-in on a movie that's being shot in Casablanca. There's a famous American actress who's in Casablanca, where actually a lot of movies are shot in Morocco because there's a great film school there. But so she's in the movie's being shot in Casablanca, and the famous American actress's stand-in has to leave because of an emergency. And so our protagonist, is chosen to be the stand-in for the famous American actress. The two become very close, the two women, and soon the protagonist finds herself standing in for the famous American actress off-screen as well, and her adventures take her deeper and darker into the Casablanca night.
I wanted to talk about the setting of Morocco. So when it opens, your protagonist is flying to Casablanca. How did you choose Morocco for the setting?
I didn't go to Morocco with the intention of setting a book there. What happened is I was traveling there a couple of years ago, and I wasn't planning on setting anything there, and I didn't take any notes while I was there. But I won't go into too much detail because I don't like to draw too many comparisons and similarities between protagonists and my own experience because the book isn't all autobiographical. But let's just say while there, I did end up going to the meeting the chief of police as well. And so I ended up starting to write the book on the way home from Morocco, and I didn't intend to set a book there. I think in some ways the setting chose me.
And I also, of course, would love to talk about point of view for a bit.
Okay.
So the story is told from the second person singular point of view, the you.
Yes.
And so can you talk about choosing that to tell your story or this story?
Sure. I've never written a story or a novel in the second person, but it's always been intriguing to me. I really love Laurie Moore's stories and the second person that she sometimes uses in her stories. And I never really even made a conscious choice to write this book in the U. I started writing it in the second person, and it seemed to make a lot of sense to me, given that the protagonist, we never learn her name, but she's switching identities, and she's having her own identity struggles. And so it was, I know it, the U allowed me to be very kind of like, just allowed me to be very malleable with how I was describing her. And also, it was just a challenge for me because since I hadn't done it before, with every book that I do, I try to, I think every writer does this, I'm sure, they just try to set a new challenge for themselves so they can do something they haven't done before. And so in my case, it was choosing to do a second person.
Mm, and you mentioned before that she goes unnamed, although of course she does get a false identity, but did
right.
you...
She has double aliases.
Yeah. In your mind, did you have a name for her or no?
I do have a name for her. There's one clue when she first arrives in Casablanca at the airport. Someone holds up a card. Someone's supposed to drive her to the hotel, holds up a card with her name on it, and she says, oh, they spell it the French way. Of course they would. And so, of course, I had to think about what her name was and what, you know, it had to be the name that could be spelled the French way. And so it was only halfway through the book that I realized what I thought her name was. I knew that I wouldn't reveal it to the reader. It was just something I wanted to know as the writer.
Would you read to us from your book?
Sure. I think I'll start from the very beginning, Nicole. That way I don't have to set it up. And so you asked me to read for about 3.5 minutes, so I will do that. And this is the very start of The Diver's Clothes, Lie Empty.
Okay.
When you find your seat, you glance at the businessman sitting next to you and decide he's almost handsome. This is the second leg of your trip from Miami to Casablanca, and the distance traveled already has muted the horror of the last 2 months. What's to stop you from having a conversation with this man, possibly even ordering 2 vodka tonics with the little lemon wedges that the flight attendant will place into your plastic cups with silver tongs? He's around your age, 33, and like you, appears to be traveling alone. He has 2 newspapers on his lap, one in Arabic and the other in English. If you get along well enough, you could enjoy a meal together once you get to Casablanca. You'll go to dinner and you'll sit on plush embroidered pillows and eat couscous with your hands. Afterwards, you'll pass by the strange geometry of an unknown skyline as you make your way back to one of your hotels. Isn't this what people do when they're alone and abroad? But as you get settled into your seat next to this businessman, he tells you he plans to sleep the entire flight to Casablanca. Then, with a considerable and embarrassing amount of effort, he inflates a neck pillow with his thin lips, places a small pill on his outstretched tongue, and turns away from you and toward the oval window, the shade of which has already been shut. As the flight takes off, the inevitable cries of babies start up, and you absentmindedly flip through your guidebook to Morocco. You read, "The first thing to do upon arriving in Casablanca is get out of Casablanca. Damn, you've already booked a hotel room there for 3 nights. You should be annoyed with yourself for not reading the guidebook before reserving and paying for your room. But instead, you direct your annoyance at the guidebook itself for telling you your first 3 days in Morocco will be wasted. You stuff the book deep into your backpack and remove your camera. It's a few months old, and though you've used it, you've kept it in its box with the instructions, which you have not yet read. You decide now is a good time to read them and figure out how to download the photos of your newborn niece onto your laptop. You turn the camera on, it's a Pentax, a professional camera that's nicer than you need, and study a photo of your niece on the day she was born. You feel your eyes start to well up, and you turn the camera off. The plane has still not reached a comfortable cruising altitude, and the seatbelt sign has not yet been turned off. But this doesn't prevent a Western-looking woman across the aisle and 2 rows ahead from standing up. Wearing a dress patterned with autumnal leaves, even though it's spring, she removes her carry-on suitcase from the overhead compartment. Then she sits down, places it on her lap, opens it, shifts a few items meticulously packed clothing around to a different position within the case, closes it, and lifts the suitcase back up to the overhead compartment. A flight attendant briskly approaches and reminds her the seatbelt sign is illuminated. The woman in the autumnal dress sits for 5 minutes before she's unable to control herself and stands once more to retrieve her suitcase, place it in her lap, open it, and rearrange the clothing before restoring the suitcase to the cabinet above her seat. Your fellow passengers, half of whom look like tourists and half like they might be Moroccans returning home, make eye contact with you and with each other, and pupils are rolled. It's collectively understood that this woman is suffering from an obsessive-compulsive disorder. When the woman in the tunnel dress stands for a third time, the passenger seated in front of her, holding a book and wearing glasses, abruptly turns around to stare. She is part of a group of women who have been traveling with you since Miami. Judging by their Florida State University sweatshirts and the approximate age, you assume they attended FSU together almost 40 years ago and are on a reunion trip. There's something familiar about this bespectacled woman who's now turned and looking back, and as you lock eyes for a moment, you sense she's maybe wondering if she recognizes you from somewhere. You spot one of this woman's sneakers turned outward in the aisle, a clean, puffy, white Reebok, and you immediately know where you last saw her. Your heart races the way it does when you've had too much caffeine. You avert your eyes from hers and concentrate on the seat back in front of you. You pull down the tray table and place your head on it. You do not want this woman to recognize you, to ask you questions. And I'll stop there.
Thank you. That was Venda Levita reading from her new book, The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And it was great to hear that again, having read the book. So it helps me appreciate just how crafted this beginning is, because you really have done a lot there. When you were writing the first draft, how did the beginning go? Was it, has this always been the opening scene or?
Right. It was definitely the original first draft took place on a plane as well, but I didn't know all the, I didn't know exactly where the plot was going when I first wrote the first draft of the novel. And so later on when I knew what was happening, I went back and put in little details, that if you've read the book the first time and when you go back through, you see what she's alluding to later on, what the protagonist is, and what she's seeing, and why these, you know, for example, why the white puffy sneaker alarms her so much, and you know who this woman is to her, and what she represents. When I first wrote the scene in the first draft, it was, I think I even started with a different, definitely started with a different line. The first line originally was something like, why is everyone clapping? And I started with the landing Casablanca, and I changed it for many reasons. The ending probably changed, I mean, the beginning and the ending both changed the most significantly, more significantly than any other parts of the book and in subsequent drafts. But the beginning also, I realized when using the second person with you, is I had to introduce it as soon as possible. And so my original first line, why is everyone clapping, kind of delayed the introduction of you. Does that make sense? Like, it didn't appear until like three paragraphs down. And by that point, I think every reader just assumed it was third person or first person or something like that. And so the you was more jarring. And so that's what changed in the subsequent drafts.
I see. And I also was curious, because you have this relatively short time frame and it's a linear structure. And so it sounds like you knew from the beginning, though, that this story would be conscripted in a relatively short amount of time.
Yes, I knew that there wouldn't be. I don't think I've ever written a book that's jumped over big periods of time. I like books that are kind of condensed and happen within a week or 2 weeks of someone's life. Maybe for my next book, I'll try to make big time jumps as a challenge for myself. But I like reading books that take place in a constrained period of time. I like watching plays that take place in one scene in one hotel. Or one room, and so I think there's something interesting about what happens when you put these constraints on a story that you're trying to tell.
And also with regard to the linearity, because even with regard to flashbacks, they're so economically used, and I know that's partly by design because of the nature of the story. But did that, as a writer more generally, do you have a take on flashbacks? Like, do you try to avoid them, or
I try not to make them too long. I think the longest flashback I have in one of my books is maybe 15 pages or something. That's in The Lovers, and I think that's kind of told as a separate story, like an official, a backstory. But one thing with this book is I knew I wanted to move very quickly with The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty, and I didn't want to have, for example, there are chapter breaks in the book. It goes all the way, it goes straight through. So because I think in some ways it's intended to be read in one sitting, if someone has that kind of has a time to read it in one sitting. I personally love novels that I can sit down and read, after dinner and before bed. Those are my favorite kinds of books. And so I think you obviously try to write the kind of book sometimes that you like to read. And so to get back to the flashback question you asked, I think that when you're trying to keep something moving forward and trying to keep the momentum, you don't want your flashbacks to be too long, because they can just kind of, drag the book down or drag the story down.
Right. You don't want it to be too long. And I'm just going to say, personally, as a writer, I think I use them as a crutch. Like, I think they're really tempting. And so, mm-hmm. But you, if that is even a temptation for you, you clearly resist, because they're only necessary, the ones that are there.
I think I just, I think it's fun to kind of give clues to the reader about what's happening in someone's life, and kind of giving clues to the past, and so the reader can kind of look at a flashback and use it kind of as puzzle pieces to figure out who this character is or why they're acting the way they are. And I think ideally, when the flashbacks work, each of them really is a puzzle that if the reader took together, they could really get a full picture of the protagonist.
Mm. I'm talking to Venda Levita. Her book, The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty, has just been released by Echo. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Vandala, when you read those opening pages for us, you mentioned the character of the woman with the puffy Reeboks. And so I just wanted to talk about coincidences in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a conventional guideline about them that only use them if they make things harder on the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And here it seems to somehow even go deeper than that with the second person and the identity thing. And I don't know, can you talk about working with coincidences in this book and your approach or your take on using them?
Well, I did want this book to be very much a novel about doubles, in the sense that, especially because she's working as a stand-in, the protagonist is a twin. Obviously, I'm just right away introducing the concept of doubles. The coincidences, it was kind of fun because I'd set up that way. I could kind of play with coincidences more than I think I have in the past, and not be as afraid of them, because I do think coincidences happen in real life a lot, and so it's just a matter of making sure they're believable in fiction. And I think I had to take a couple of coincidences out because I felt like there were just too many that were just being layered on top of each other. But I felt in some ways that coincidences worked for the theme of this book.
Mm-hmm. So on this show, T. Jefferson Parker has talked about the importance of writing with velocity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, do you write with velocity, or what's your take on time?
Definitely. I think, particularly with this book, I was circling it for a couple of years, and I had some thoughts about it, and I had some scenes written, but it wasn't until after I went to Morocco and figured out what my opening was based on, something that I experienced there, that it really all fell into place for me. And once I knew what the story was, and I knew I had my beginning, I wanted to write as quickly as possible, mainly because I was afraid of losing the world that I had in my head. I didn't want to stop writing because I wanted the book to read quickly, and I felt sometimes if you want a book to read quickly, you have to write it quickly. And that doesn't mean you don't go through it, back over it 100 times after you've written a draft, but I wanted to get that first draft down with extreme velocity, and that was something I strove for. So I tried to get rid of all the other distractions in my life and really lock myself in and get a first draft done.
Mm. Do you read your reviews?
No, I don't. I think that I was just saying this to a friend the other day. I feel like good reviews go to your head and bad reviews go to your heart, and in neither situation is necessarily good things. If you get a good review and it goes to your head, it just makes you, it could make you lazier as a writer, I think. And if a bad review goes to your heart, it makes it that much harder to sit down and write the next time. Or, something sticks in your head. It could be a perfectly good review, and there'll be one line saying, I think that the writer should have set this book on Mars or something. And then so the next time you sit down to write, you find yourself saying, one day on Mars. And I think that's not exactly helpful either. So I don't read reviews at all.
You're not even tempted?
No.
So I was wondering if you could tell us about this organization that you helped found.
826 Valencia?
Yes, 826 Valencia.
Yeah. So 826 Valencia started in 2002, and I'm a founding board member of it. We started in San Francisco, and it was just help serve kids ages, now it's 5 to 18, then it was more like 8 to 18 with their writing needs and their after-school homework. So it started on Valencia Street. The address is 826 Valencia, and we started as a drop-in tutoring center. And this was a time in San Francisco when we knew a lot of writers who had flexible hours. And as a writer, you can't write all day long. You can write for maybe 5 hours, 6 hours, but you can't write all day. And so, what do you do with your extra time? And this was also a time when more people in San Francisco had more flexible jobs. I think before and I think they still do now, but it was definitely started at a particular time, particular place. And we used to open our doors to neighborhood kids in the Mission, and had volunteers there who were all, you know, none of them were paid, they're all volunteers, and they would sit side by side with these students, helping them with their homework and their writing skills, and helping them with, you know, English language learners with their skills as well.
And this began in 2002. Do you know if it's inspired similar programs elsewhere?
There are now A26s in many cities across the country, and there are some sister programs, I call them sister programs, in other countries, like in London and in Ireland, in Dublin, Ireland. And I visited one center in Stockholm, Sweden, and there's one in Amsterdam. So there are definitely some like-minded centers that have started as well.
Mm. We're drawing down on our time, but before we let you go, I wanted to talk about writing advice. So
okay.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you can share with our audience with regard to, you know, craft?
To crafting or to actually getting the words down or just general writing advice?
Oh,
what do you think is most helpful?
I think general writing advice.
Okay. I don't know if I have that much advice, because one thing I've learned that helps me a lot as in writing and getting a book done is to actually set yourself a word count limit or word count goal for every day that you're writing. And I started doing this many years ago when I realized, when I was saying to myself, I'm just going to sit at my desk from 9 to 5 or whatever I was doing, I would find lots of excuses not to write. I would read a book that was related to something I was working on and call that research and think, okay, well, I've done my job for today. Or I would, you know, look up something on the internet that was related to my book in some tangential way and think that that was, you know, counting toward my work hours, and so to speak. And it was only when I started setting a word goal for myself that it really kept myself honest. So I would say, okay, today you're going to write 500 words, maybe tomorrow 1,000 words. And then once I figured out what word count seemed to work for me, I would stick to that. So a good pace is usually 1,000 words a day for me. I find that works well. And that's not to say that I keep all those words, but for me it's really important just to get the words down on the paper. And when I've taught students at 826 Valencia, I've taught high schoolers, you know, a novella class, for example, and I've given them the same advice to have a word count of maybe 500 words a day because they were writing after school or before school. And it really is amazing how those words just add up, and pretty soon, before you know it, you have a novella, you have a short story, you have something that's a draft, and I think it's really exciting to have something on paper that's finished that you can then go back and look at and figure out how to improve.
Mm. And how about when you're in the revising stage? Do you then carve out some time for a new project and maintain that word goal, or do you alter it? Do you have an alternate, you know, goal set program for revising?
For revising, it's not so much words. It's more like I'll think, okay, I'll divide the book into 10 sections or whatever amount of sections, and think, okay, today I'll get through this section, and then tomorrow that section. And sometimes I think it's when you're revising too, it's fun to not necessarily work on those sections. After maybe like your third draft through, I think it can be helpful to not read the sections chronologically, because then you're actually looking for something else. You're looking for the sentence structure. You're looking for metaphors, you're looking for the word choices, you're looking at dialogue. And I have a friend who reads her books backwards when she's done, literally starts with the last sentence and, you know, goes backwards. And that just helps her really make sure the sentences are good, and it makes her, it distracts her from thinking about plot or continuity. And I think there are different tricks you can use like that when you're revising to really make yourself look at all aspects of the book, not just the plot and not just the story, but the actual words and sentences.
Vendela, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Vendela Vita, author of the new book, The Diver's Clothes Lie Empty, published by Echo, an imprint of HarperCollins. She'll be at Skylight Books in Los Angeles on June 15th at 7:30. During the second part of the show, author Samantha Harvey will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with Vendela Vita. Next up, I'll be speaking with novelist Samantha Harvey. Samantha is the author of The Wilderness and All Is Song and has been shortlisted for the Orange Prize for Fiction and the Guardian First Book Award, as well as longlisted for the Booker Prize. She is a winner of the Betty Task Prize and is a member of the Academy for the Folio Prize. She lives in Bath, England, where she teaches creative writing. And her latest novel is Dear Thief, which is a brand new Echo Trade paperback. And I'm so pleased to welcome her to the show. Hi there, Samantha.
Hi, Nicole.
So we find that no one introduces a book better than the author. Would you introduce Dear Thief to us?
Yeah, I will try, although I'm not sure it's true that no one introduces a book better than the author. Sometimes authors don't make a great job of it. But this is a long letter, sort of a long love letter. It's from a woman to an old estranged friend. She hasn't seen her for 15 years or so. And the friend, who is called Nina and also nicknamed Butterfly, left after having an affair with the letter writer's husband. So although there's a long friendship between them, there's also a very sort of fractious relationship and lots of unspoken resentment and a lack of forgiveness. And so the book is all in the form of one long letter that may or may not have been sent. And it is the letter writer, who is nameless throughout, trying to both communicate with her friend and also try to exact a kind of revenge on her, I suppose, by putting forward her version of events and trying to chart the landscape of her emotions, which are in a great deal of flux, sort of range from hatred to really enduring love and an attempt at forgiveness. So it's sort of emotionally complex and very long letter that's written over about 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm. And would you also talk about the starting point for us? So what was the inspiration for this novel?
It's a novel that has quite a few influences. Its main influence, which is very apparent and manifest for anyone who makes the connection, is the Leonard Cohen song, Famous Blue Raincoat. I took that song as sort of a template, and the song is obviously, for anyone who knows it, will know it's about a love triangle, or possibly about a love triangle. Cohen was quite evasive about that, but it appears to be about a love triangle. It's a letter from one man to another, to his friend, and it implies that there was some sort of love triangle that happened some years before. So I took that as the template because I love the song, because it's such a mysterious song, and I wanted to interpret it and see if I could strike that kind of mysterious and melancholic key that's in the song. But it also has other sort of influences as all about love triangles, really. A very short Harold Pinter play, which is called Monologue, which is also a friend talking to an absent friend about a love triangle. And there are a few other references in the book to love triangles in other art forms, songs, books, so on. So it's a very influenced novel in a way, and it references other art forms, which is something I've quite enjoyed doing and playing with. But its main influence is definitely the Leonard Cohen song.
Mm. And I had read that, actually, and I like that idea of mysteries being everywhere and just you know, your creative mind settling on that one to explore. Could you read to us from your book?
Sure, yeah. I think this piece needs no introduction.
Okay.
Are you better? I'm not naive. It seems clear to me that there's something very wrong in a language that uses the same word to mean improved and cured. By better, I mean only improved. Are you? That day you came back, you telephoned us from the station, and I went to collect you. You were standing at the end of the platform with your head down and your weight off one foot, in the way I've seen wounded wolves stand in films like Once Upon a Time in the West. Not that I've seen this film, but this is how I imagine it to be. It had been almost 2 years since we'd seen you before that. When I got home and we asked where you'd been, you said, I've been in an elevator going up and down. So we sat you out in the garden at the mossy table and gave you tea and asked you again, I've been in an elevator looking for love. for 2 years, we asked. Love is hard to find. The garden was blowing with leaves, and Nicholas put his elbows on the table with an attempt at anchorage and a seriousness that was almost morbid. He said, "So did you find it?" "I didn't find the one, but I found a lot of people I wasn't looking for, and I made do." He asked, "Who were you looking for?" And you told him, "Laurence Olivier." He stood sharply and walked indoors. Your moods were the stuff of legend, and that day your mood could only be described as dangerous. Languorous, facetious, self-absorbed, you were amused by yourself. And this was the worst of all possible states, because it was the kind of amusement I imagine Caiaphas felt when he made a deal with the devil. The amusement is a mask for the wretchedness we feel for striking up an unhappy alliance. In your case, this alliance was with yourself, whom you'd long thought badly of and were always escaping. But on that day, it was as though you'd recognized that you owned only yourself, were shipwrecked with yourself. And your mood reflected your disgust at this most desperate, careless misfortune. Later that evening, you went on the train to London, and Nicholas went with you. "I'm getting out," was the last thing you said to me when the two of you left for the station. Nicholas came back alone 2 days later, and that was that where the three of us were concerned. Get out of what? This mess? This life? I've always wondered, and I will only ask you once. Did you manage it? Did you get out?
Thank you. That was novelist Samantha Harvey reading from her novel, Dear Thief. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. So we have the three main characters there, and we get the flavor for the letter writing, and in fact, that section, unlike, you know, all of the letters, but that one does delve into the you. Can you talk a little bit? I know it's a particular you in the context of a letter, but was that an issue for you, writing in the second person for those sections?
I really enjoyed writing in the second person. I know it's quite an unpopular way of writing, and it can feel forced and quite pretentious, and it can also have the effect in a novel of alienating the reader, because the writer is addressing a particular person, so it seems that it's a drama that's going on irrespective of the reader, that the reader is shut out of. So it's a risky, very difficult thing to pull off in a novel, I think. But I guess because this is a letter, it allows that. It's the letter's natural form. So I wanted to just play around with it, and I loved the opportunities that it brings, because when you are addressing a you, the words acquire a kind of direction of travel and an urgency, because they are aimed from one place directly to another. They've got somewhere to land. They've got someone to receive them. And so I really enjoyed that borrowed urgency that they have. Also, the way that they are direct, you can speak directly to a you in a letter, but you can also afford to be that little bit bolder or that little bit more oblique, because it's the written form. You don't have to look that person in the eye. You don't have to sort of confront their response. So you can just sort of play around with your feelings and with stories, and they have no way of coming back at you. And that's something that the letter writer does reference, and she explores that she's got this whole open territory to explore, and Butterfly Nina can't come back at her, can't object, can't argue with her, can't put her right, can't ever make her feel ashamed or bad. So it was a lot of fun writing the second person, and something I really enjoy doing and would really like to do again at some point.
That's interesting. I'm going to, for this next question, which is also about craft, briefly quote from this lovely review from The New Yorker, The New Yorker's James Wood. He says, "The novel drifts fairly often into the pressureless zones of retrospect." And so How do you manage the retrospection in this novel and preserve the narrative thrust?
That's a million-dollar question. It's true, as James Wood says, is when you do go into retrospection, it is pressureless. It's not moving forwards. It hasn't got that sort of narrative drive that readers look for and depend upon. So I think that the only way of doing it is by making sure that retrospection is always serving some other greater forward motion. So when my letter writer goes into retrospection, she's not ever just idly reminiscing. There's always a point that she's trying to make, and she might make it in quite a circumspect way, and she might be quite digressive about getting there, which is part of the remit of the letter, that you could sort of take the time you want. You can arrive at your point in the time that you want, but it's always driven by a motive, an emotional motive usually, which is to get across something you've been meaning to say for years. And this letter is full of that sort of thing, that this is something I've wanted to tell you for years, and here's another thing I've wanted to tell you for years. And she goes about that in a rather long-winded way sometimes, but the hope is that all of the retrospection is always and only ever at the service of the forward motion of the plot, so that it's never irrelevant, it's never superfluous, it's always driving things forward, either in terms of event or in terms of emotional currency.
Mm. And the language you use and the speculation and the thoughts in those sections are so nicely wrought. I was interested in your background because you do have, as I understand, a master's in creative writing, but what else have you done?
Well, I started off when I was at university doing philosophy, and I did a master's in philosophy, and I wanted to go on into an academic career. I wanted to do that for a while, and then I realized, although it might seem a bit of an improbable thing to say, the world of academic philosophy is actually quite, I found it quite a small-minded and quite backstabbing sort of environment to be in, and I decided it just wasn't interesting to me. And actually, the questions that were being thrown up in my reading about philosophy and reading philosophy itself were questions that I thought I could address much better in a non-academic way. So I started writing, and when I started writing fiction, just sort of shorter pieces of fiction and, you know, early ideas for novels, I found that my interest in philosophy was inflecting that fiction I was writing, and that for me, fiction was a much better way of trying to look at philosophical questions. So I see novels, I suppose, as very expanded thought experiments, which is what philosophy is largely about as well. So you can take an idea, whatever it is, and you can play it out as an experiment in a novel and see what happens to it, see what happens when it's dramatized and when it's walking and talking. So to me, I think I've found my own perfect expression for my interest in philosophy, which wasn't satisfied by academic philosophy, and I don't think ever really would have been. And it's a very watered-down form of philosophy. I don't really claim to write philosophical novels. I just write novels that are about ideas that interest me, and I try to see what happens to them when characters are affected by them, and you know, when those ideas intersect with a life.
We're talking to novelist Samantha Harvey. Her novel is Dear Thief. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. And Samantha, I was curious who some of the writers are that you admire, because you have such a unique voice. Although I did, maybe due to the philosophical nature of the writing, I thought of Siri Hustvedt when I was reading your work. But how about you? Like, who are some of your influences?
That's always a difficult question to answer. I don't know who my influences are. I'm not sure that I'm very conscious of that. But the writers that I love are, well, I love Graham Greene. I love the Portuguese novelist José Saramago. I love Virginia Woolf. I love Marilynne Robinson. Lots of European writers I really enjoy reading. And then some of the sort of old, you know, Thomas Hardy's, the old classics of English literature I love. So many. It's difficult to sort of pick them out, but there are those that I always return to, and I would say, you know, of those, probably Graham Greene is one of my real old favourites, mainly because he is so amazingly adept at combining sort of high thoughtful literature with really great plotting. I think that's really difficult to do, so I sort of use him as a bit of a master, really, a bit of a teacher. My reading is quite broad, and it's very hard to narrow down.
When you're collecting your ideas for your books, do you keep a notebook of observations or thoughts, or how do you organize that?
Yeah, I'm not really a writer who does carry a notebook around. I think I rely on memory, really, so a sort of a natural sifting process that our own minds undergo when we observe things. So if I observe something and if it really impacts on me and it seems relevant, then I just trust that it will surface at an appropriate time. I find if I write things down, I end up with just lots and lots of notes that start to make me anxious because I feel like I ought to use them. Whereas if I don't do that, it just allows a sort of natural surfacing of things. And certainly in my novels, things come up, occur to me that happened years ago and I've no idea where they came from, and suddenly they're just there in my mind. I mean, I was commissioned to write a short story last year for radio here in the UK, and I had a very broad theme, but I had about 2 weeks to write it and I had no idea what to do, and suddenly I remembered a snake that I'd seen many years before in a zoo, and I'd found this snake absolutely beautiful to look at. It was a very exquisite snake, and I suddenly remembered it, and I wrote a story about this snake, and I had no idea where that memory came from. But I think there's a fair amount of trust that you have to place in your own observations and your own memories and let them surface when it's appropriate and when they're needed, because they do seem to, by some kind of miraculous process, they do seem to.
That does sound like a huge amount of trust, but also I like that story about the short story and how, so you just sat down with the deadline and it emerged?
Yeah, it did, just from nowhere. In fact, I think I was lying in bed sort of late one night or early hours of the morning thinking, what shall I write? And suddenly, yeah, that just came to me, and with it came an entire story, almost full and whole, which is very unusual for me. But it just came to me. So that was a strange thing. But it was such a vivid that the snake made such a vivid impression on me at the time that I didn't need to write it down. I just sort of thought, well, if I'm ever going to use that, it will come when it needs to, and it did.
Wow, and so that short story was commissioned. Do you like to write short stories or poetry?
I like to write both. I'm not sure that either of my great strengths. I enjoy writing short stories, and I do write them from time to time. And I enjoy writing poetry, but I'm very bad at it. I think my poems are for me only. I never show them to anyone. They're not good. but short stories I love, and it's a craft I would really like to hone. It's a very different craft to writing novels, and one I have enormous respect for. You know, they're not just sort of very short novels. They're their own form, and they take enormous amount of discipline. I find when I start writing short stories, they just go on and on, and I don't know how to end them because I'm working at a novelist scale. So I would like to try to refine that and work out what a short story writer's scale is and start to explore that form more. That's one of my ambitions as a writer, I think.
We're talking to novelist Samantha Harvey. Her novel is Dear Thief. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Before we let you go, I want to ask you if you have any writing advice for our writer listeners out there, and maybe you can talk about that first novel. So how, for someone struggling to complete and, you know, say goodbye to a first novel, do you have any advice?
You know, I did do a creative writing MA, but I had already written a novel before that. And I think even having done a master's and having really got a lot from it and enjoyed it, I do believe that the main way you learn to write is by writing, and that probably sounds like a platitude and not very helpful advice, but so much of it is learnt in the doing. So I would say that you need a routine of sorts, however many hours that is a week, whether you can spend a lot of hours or very few, but a routine and some time in which you prioritize writing and sit and do it and trust the process. Keep at it even when it's not offering anything back. Just keep doing it. And trust that you will learn what you need as you go, which you do, and it can be quite a long and painful process. And I think in a way it never gets easier either. I mean, Dear Thief is my fourth novel, my third published novel, but my fourth novel, and I can't say it was any easier to write than any of the others. It's not an easy thing to do, but it's something that you can get better at and that you learn mainly by doing, not by reading about, not by studying, but just by doing it. And I think also just the last point to add is having real clarity of purpose about what it is you're writing. I think that it's very easy with a novel to just have a faint notion of a character or of a place or the faintest grasp of a story and to start writing. And then getting to about 10 or 20,000 words and just running out of steam and not really knowing what it is that is at the heart of the novel, you know, what its necessity is, what necessitates it existing. And I think knowing what that is and maybe having a statement that you use for yourself that tells you what that novel is, what it's about in a very clear way is enormously helpful, and I always have that for my own novels. So, yeah, I'd say perseverance and real clarity of purpose are the two main things.
Well, Samantha, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
That was Samantha Harvey. Her new book is Dear Thief, out now in Echo Trade Paperback. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, I'll be back with Mary Beth Hughes and Lauren Acampora. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue, coming right up on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.